Is it possible that a good and merciful God consign anyone to hell, a place of unending, excruciating pain, no matter what evil that person may have done? To answer this question, we do well to start with Christ's parable of the Last Judgment in Matthew 25, where the king will separate the nations, placing some on his right and others on his left. To those on his right, he will say, "Come, O blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world." Those on his left, however, he will consign to the eternal fire prepared for the devil and his angels. These destinies are not parallel. The sheep on the king's right are invited into a place, indeed a kingdom, prepared for them. This is the destiny that God has in mind for every human being, as the Second Vatican Council teaches us. For their part, the goats are consigned to the fire prepared for the devil and his angels. A human being can go to hell, but it is not God's plan. So we start with the parameters of the discussion. To understand the last things, we need to understand the nature and reality of spiritual beings. So, when Christ speaks of the devil and his angels, he is not speaking metaphorically. The scriptures and Christian tradition are abundantly clear. Angels exist. Angels are spiritual beings, by which we mean that their existence is centered on truth and goodness. The spiritual powers by which they live are intellect, the power to know and understand truth, and will, the power to love the good as known and to choose it. The destiny and perfection of any spiritual being is to know truth and possess the good in love. Because the fullness of truth exists only in the wisdom of God's providence, and because the prototype of every true good lies in the Creator's perfection, then the destiny and perfection of every spiritual being can only be God. More precisely, every spiritual being is destined to the eternal vision of the divine essence, and all that is in the mind of God. This means that the destiny of the spiritual being is the vision of perfect truth. There's a catch. Although communion with God is the destiny and perfection of every spiritual creature, no created intellect is capable of attaining to that vision by its own power. The only way that the created intellect can attain to the vision of God is by grace, by God's gift. If one does not accept God's offer of himself in love and friendship, then he cannot enter into eternal communion with him. And here's the rub. Some angels, led by the most brilliant among them, Satan, rejected God's offer of intimacy with him and chose to rely instead on their own powers to perfect themselves. If, as we can readily see, lowly human beings can know so much about the world and even about God's existence and nature, then how much more can a powerful intellect like Satan's know? Aware of his own surpassing intellectual powers, Satan rejected God's offer of communion with him. The immediate result of this choice was that Satan was not welcomed into the intimate communion with and vision of God. He chose to rely on his own resources for his perfection and happiness, and thereby rejected his true fulfillment. Therefore, although the most intelligent of beings, Satan is incapable of directly grasping the fullness of truth that is offered to every spirit that accepts God's invitation. Human beings are also spiritual beings, and as such, our lives center on truth and goodness. Unlike the angels, we have bodies, and our relationship with truth and the good is mediated through the body. We respond to God in space and time by performing limited acts based on more or less wise and intelligent choices. We may, like Plato, seek eternal truth, but we also want to know everyday truth. Where are my glasses? Who was Jack the Ripper? Why did the dinosaurs go extinct? Angels know what they know immediately. To get to the truth, we ask around, examine our environments, and do science. Equally important, we formulate the truths we know by processing signals in our brains. We cannot think and gain knowledge without brains. Similarly, our quest for the good is mediated through the body and our appetites. St. Augustine famously wrote, "You made us for yourself, and our heart is restless until it rests in you." But we are also restless if the plane is delayed. Mine was canceled yesterday evening. Besides thirsting for God, we crave a cold beer. For the human being, to discern the nature of goodness is a lifelong project. The infant seeks milk from the breast and comes to crave the sweetness of candy. As an adult, she may savor the complex tastes of French cuisine as she increasingly attends to her cholesterol. For his part, the revolutionary prisoner refuses all food. Hunger is a small price to pay for freedom. The embodied spirit, developing in space and time, discerns the good slowly, by fits and starts, as it were. Like the angels, we human beings are offered eternal communion with God, albeit in the afterlife. In this life, however, we respond to God's offer by expressing our love for the good in space and time. Like the angels, we can ask for and accept God's grace, or, like Satan, we can refuse it. We turn to Dismas and the Final Judgment. As Christ hangs in agony on the cross, the onlookers and soldiers mock him. "Save yourself." Even one of the two criminals crucified with him joins in. "Are you not the Christ? Save yourself and us." This is in Luke 23. The other criminal rebukes his comrade. "Do you not fear God? We are receiving the due reward of our deeds, but this man has done nothing wrong." Dismas had been a bad man, a wrongdoer. He also knows that Jesus was innocent, not deserving the cross. He then says to Jesus, "Remember me when you come in your kingly power." And amazingly, Jesus replies, "Truly I say to you, today you will be with me in paradise." Dismas simply asks Jesus to remember him, and Jesus promises him eternal happiness with him on that very day. Here we find an interplay, not between good and evil, but between mercy and evil. The good thief never expressly repents of his crimes. He never makes amends. Had a band of armed zealots swept down upon the Via Dolorosa and set the prisoners free, the good thief may very well have used his freedom to return to his wicked ways. We don't know. We do know that when his presumed partner in crime railed at Jesus, joining in the mockery of others, Dismas took Jesus' part. Like, knock it off, man. He didn't deserve it. He showed mercy to Jesus the only way he could. Then he asked this dying king of the Jews to remember him in his kingdom. What was Dismas thinking? We don't know. He seemed to know that Jesus was merciful, and he asked this helpless, suffering Jesus to show mercy to him. He expressed faith and showed mercy, and Jesus granted mercy to Dismas. This same principle is at work in the Final Judgment. The king's criteria in the Last Judgment are the works of mercy: feeding the hungry, giving drink to the thirsty, clothing the naked, and visiting prisoners. Those who do these will inherit the mansions God has prepared for them. Let us note that the blessed of my Father were not responding to explicit commands. There is no rule book for mercy, no list of required merciful works that one can check off. In Christ's story of the rich man and Lazarus in Luke 16, the rich man did no harm to Lazarus. He just ignored him, closed his heart. Lacking mercy, he was consigned to the realm of the merciless, the place prepared for Satan and his angels. When Jesus, the King, speaks of the acts of mercy, he describes them as having been done for him. And the blessed respond by asking, "Lord, when did we see thee hungry and feed thee, or thirsty and give thee drink?" The answer, of course, is St. Mother Teresa's five-finger gospel. you did it for me. Their qualification for a place in the kingdom is that they did for Jesus as Jesus does for us. Those who shared in Jesus' mercy by being merciful themselves will live in his kingdom. By the same token, those who showed no mercy to the poor, the hungry, the imprisoned, will find themselves shut out from their inheritance. They must go somewhere else. This brings us to a key truth about judgment. To think that a good God could not send a sinner to hell is to understand neither the goodness and mercy of God nor the wickedness of sin. God's judgment goes much deeper than prescribed punishments for proscribed offenses. Those who will not live by the law of love, expressed in mercy, must needs live by the law of Satan. This is the hell of hell. We'll talk about Satan's psychology. Spiritual beings live by ideas. They discover ideas, develop them, and apply them to bring order into chaos. An idea is a principle of unity among diverse realities. For instance, Isaac Newton conceived the idea of mass to explain both gravitational and inertial motion. With this one idea, he could account for the flight of a projectile and the motions of the moon and planets. Tchaikovsky wove some Russian peasant songs, the Marseillaise, an Orthodox hymn, and God Save the Tsar into one coherent piece of orchestral music, the 1812 Overture. In virtue of the spiritual capacity to use ideas, rulers can bring order to their societies. Societies are ordered by ideas, some good, some bad. Satan is a ruler. As the brightest, the smartest of beings, from his perspective at least, there is none better than he to bring order to the world. Having rejected the vision of the divine wisdom, he literally cannot, or perhaps will not, conceive of an order higher and more perfect than that which comes from his own mind. By any reasonable standard, therefore, Satan should rule the world, and particularly the lives of human beings. Just ask him. We don't need to ask him. In the demonic world, Satan sets the standards for truth. Satan determines what is truly good. We see this conception at work in the serpent's temptation in the garden. This is Genesis 3. God knows that when you eat of the fruit, your eyes will be opened, and you will be like God, knowing good and evil. He lied. But the tempter knows the power of his lie. To be like God, not subordinate to him, but to stand on a plane of equality with him. Knowing this, we can understand the satanic mind. We can know his psychology. Satan thought that even without the vision of God, he could know enough about God to judge between himself and God. Well, what is it to be God? What we call God is the supreme being, the author of reality, arbiter and standard of truth, exemplar of every good, and most admirable of all beauties. Whatever fits that description must be God. The claims of atheism notwithstanding, everyone believes in God. The real question is the identity of God. If God is the supreme being, the author of truth who ascribes meaning to reality, if he is the most admirable of beauties and the criterion of all goodness, then might I not be God, at least in my own world? If we think about it carefully, the idea is not so far-fetched. Jean-Paul Sartre effectively said that the thinking subject is supreme within his own subjectivity. God does not define me. It is up to me to define myself. Although Sartre's existentialism was starkly dramatic, he was right in this way. A person can live like this. The world I live in is my reality. If others disagree, trying to impose their reality on me, even to the extent of citing evidence and logical arguments, I can still live in my own world. There need be no universal standard of goodness. No one has the right to impose values on me. Furthermore, it is not necessary to affirm or even to recognize Sartre's existentialist theses. One can simply live by them. Socrates tells us, the unexamined life is not worth living. But I can live blithely and unreflectively as though I am the center of my universe. And that makes me, to a limited extent at least, my own God. This is what the serpent promised to Eve. You will be like God, knowing good and evil. Believing in myself as the God of my life, I unwittingly renounce hope of God's mercy. I live in despair. To live under Satan's rule is to live at odds with reality. To live as though I'm God is to live at odds with reality. In truth, God is the creator. Only he knows fully the true order of things. Ask any scientist. As much as we know, and we can know a great deal, we do not know what we do not know is immeasurably greater. Satan's truth, according to which he rules, and by which his subjects are obliged to live, is the product of his own mind. He thinks he knows it all, but he doesn't. It's the product of his mind imposed on those he rules. It is limited by the scope of his own understanding. It is an ideology, a system of belief, that Václav Havel calls, this is how he characterizes ideology, quote, a specious way of relating to the world. It enables people to deceive their conscience and conceal their true position and their inglorious modus vivendi, both from the world and from themselves. To live by an ideology is not to live by reason, not really, but by the rewards and punishment determined by the demonic overlord. Therefore, Satan is rightly called the father of lies. That's in John 9. He cannot tolerate the honest search for truth by his subjects. We have seen an image of this, and not all that long ago. His name was Joseph Vissarionovich Chugashvili, Stalin. Within the borders of the Soviet Union, he was the author of truth, the arbiter of good and evil, the judge of all that is beautiful, and if you doubt this, ask Dmitri Shostakovich, to all intents and purposes, God, at least until he died. If Solzhenitsyn is to be believed, Stalin saw himself as being roughly on an equal footing with God, albeit within the more limited realm of the USSR. In one of his novels, Solzhenitsyn represents Stalin engaged in a puzzled conversation with God. If God is almighty, then why doesn't he deal properly with his enemies? Stalin knew what to do with enemies, but God seems not to. The divine status that Stalin arrogated to himself parallels that which the immortal and incomparably more intelligent Satan had arrogated to himself. Indeed, among created beings, none could compare with this fallen angel. Unaware of the fullness of God's nature, Satan does not bow to God. I will not serve, he insists. If God can govern the universe, so too can he. If God is to be obeyed, so too is he. Even better than Stalin, Satan knows how to handle enemies. If God is creator, then Satan is at least the demiurge, one who reshapes what God has wrought according to his own satanic plan. If God wants to rule the universe as a whole, fine. But Satan can seize a part of it for himself, his own kingdom to be ruled according to his own not inconsiderable intelligence. In short, Satan is envious and vengeful. The Book of Wisdom writes, through the devil's envy, death entered the world, and those who belong to his party experience it. In his glorious brilliance, he cannot attain to the fullness of wisdom from which he had turned away. But, and this is insulting, ordinary, lowly human beings are promised a share in God's perfect knowledge simply for asking it in faith. Like Snow White's stepmother, he cannot stand it if anyone seems to outshine him. Satan's rule on earth is circumscribed, but in his own realm, among those who have followed him, he is Lord. So we talk about the pangs of hell. Popular imagination portrays hell as a kind of torture chamber with severe pains for those who have broken God's rule. But this is not what hell is about. To see this, let us think about Auschwitz, which some have called a hell on earth. There, the underfed inmates, mocked by the motto Arbeit macht frei, were worked to death by brutal guards and overseers. Those judged useless for work were marched directly into the gas chambers and their bodies cremated in the ovens. Today, we can walk through the camp buildings and see the huge, sobering displays, large windows, of victims' eyeglasses and shoes, of murdered children's toys and clothing. Surely, if anything on earth is like hell, it must be Auschwitz. But Auschwitz was not hell. We know this because love was there. Doomed mothers still caressed their doomed children. Fathers Maximilian Kolbe and Josef Kowalski died giving aid and hope to their fellow inmates. The women assigned to the Scheisskommando, whose work it was to clean the common latrines by hand in a building so foul-smelling that the Nazi guards could not bring themselves even to enter, secretly passed messages and news among the inmates. They were almost the telephone service for Auschwitz. Despite the efficient discipline and iron will of the SS to degrade the dignity of the prisoners, they could not stamp out solidarity and love. Even in Auschwitz, evil could not triumph. When my wife, a former student, and I visited Auschwitz-Birkenau, we saw off in the distance near the crematoria a group of people wearing white capes, actually tallits, walking across the fields and praying for those who had died. These were Israeli Jews, and such groups regularly traveled to Auschwitz to remember and pray. I remember one of my own students, a woman with terribly bad knees, she had to wear these prosthetic devices, kneeling before St. Maximilian Kolbe's death cell and praying her rosary. God is not in hell, but God came to Auschwitz. Nevertheless, we can find hell in the camps. Near the entrance to the gas chamber is a small anteroom with only one window that looks into the chamber. That room is an observation post for the soldier assigned to watch the asphyxiation of the condemned and report when the execution is finished. Who is he? Our observer is not a member of the high command. He's not a Feldmarschall nor an Obersturmbannführer. He is a soldier, one who, for love of adventure and glory, out of patriotism, had joined the Wehrmacht. He knew that he would have to shoot at Russians or Frenchmen, but these were armed enemies of the Reich, trying to kill him and his fellows. The soldier is prepared for that. But in Auschwitz or Majdanek, he serves the Reich by sitting in a tiny room, looking through a thick glass window and watching as panicked, naked civilians claw at each other, desperate to escape the gas that is killing them. And the soldier sits and watches, overseeing their deaths. Our soldier, who writes home to his mother and dreams of his girlfriend back in Holstein or Bavaria, watches the killing unfold. He is not an innocent or accidental witness, but a participant in what he sees. His job is to oversee the cruel murder of hapless victims. When the last victim has died, he announces to his superiors that all are dead. His work done, he dares not entertain thoughts of compassion, thereby showing that he is weak. He must be proud of his work. As his superiors had promised, he soon enough gets used to it. Getting used to it means that he ignores the reality of what he has become and what is his true obligation to his victims. He may excuse himself, befehl ist befehl, doing the Führer's will, but he knows what he has seen and what role he played. He is a merciless killer with a maimed, if not dead, conscience. He now lives in hell, according to hell's laws, and increasingly paying hell's penalty. Hell is the fire prepared for the devil and his angels. In one respect, the hell of hell is that hell is the society of the devil and his angels. In hell, is no love, but only contempt. The common characteristic of mass murderers, so we are told, is that they want others, especially the police, to be impressed by the enormity of their crimes. In hell, however, the devils are not impressed by their prisoners' crimes. In hell, there is no community, no sharing of common interests, none of the fellowship that miscreants may have shared on earth. Envy, anger, selfishness, and resentment rule because, following the lead of hell's rulers, the damned care only for themselves. Hell is the worst society, a group of demons and human beings united by nothing good. The human being is created to the image of God. Therefore, according to Gaudium et Spes, man judges rightly that by his intellect he surpasses the material universe, for he shares in the light of the divine mind. To know the truth is an essential part of our human dignity. In hell, however, the soul is denied the dignity of knowledge. Even if the damned soul does not lose the knowledge it had gained in this life, its knowledge is worthless, because in hell the only truth is Satan's truth. The human soul is always wrong, stupid. Knowledge of the truth constitutes a part of our dignity. Even small children are delighted and proud when they know something. In hell, this is gone. The only truth is that which the demons impose. In Mel Gibson's film, Pontius Pilate, talking to his wife, expands on his question, what is truth? Truth. Do you want to know what my truth is, Claudia? If I don't condemn this man, I know Caiaphas will start a rebellion. If I do condemn him, then his followers may. Either way, there will be bloodshed. Caesar has warned me, Claudia, warned me twice. He swore that the next time the blood would be mine. That is my truth. Pilate had no time for truth. From 1,400 miles away, Caesar speaks the only truth that Pilate needs. So it is in hell. Furthermore, in hell your thoughts are not private. Naked to the view of evil spirits, the damned soul, with its doubts and disbelief, its hidden rebellion against its demonic overseers, seers, is immediately visible to their view. In the army, recruits can grumble quietly among themselves about the drill sergeants. In hell, every proud or rebellious thought is immediately visible to and promptly punished by the demons. Created in the image of God, the human person is ordered to the good. The human will is the power by which one loves and delights in the good. Its rule is manifest in conscience, where he, and I'm quoting Gaudium et Spes, detects a law which he does not impose upon himself, but which holds him to obedience, a law written by God. To obey it is the very dignity of man. Conscience, the ability to discern between good and evil, constitutes a part of the dignity of the human person, because in virtue of conscience, one can respond to what is authentically good. The person is free. Continuing Gaudium et Spes, hence man's dignity demands that he act according to a knowing and free choice that is personally motivated and prompted from within, not under blind impulse nor by mere external pressure. Even on earth, in this life, those who rule by power alone hate the notion of conscience. This is political rulers, but also your boss. You've got the wrong boss. The idea that a lowly subordinate or subject of the realm should arrogate to himself the right to judge what is right or wrong is intolerable. So it is in hell. Indeed, this absolute loss of freedom constitutes the most grievous insult of hell. Deprived of their rights to truth and to the good, those in hell have lost their freedom and dignity. So the hell of hell, its fire and pangs, lies not so much in the physical but in the spiritual. As the example of Auschwitz shows, no material situation or condition suffices to remove all good. Ens et bonum convertuntur. Being and good are convertible. The very existence of anything, and especially of rational creatures, is good. The denizens of hell have not lost what makes them to bear the image of God. They still have reason and will. What they have lost is not the good itself, but their capacity to recognize, love, and rejoice in the good. Having turned from the source and archetype of every good, the soul is blind to the good. Having accepted the lie of its own self-sufficiency, you will be like God, knowing good and evil. It despairs of the good. Good that has no reference to the self and its own wants has become unintelligible. To its mind, the good, even if there is such a thing as good, is unattainable. This life of despair is manifest in what St. John Paul II calls the threefold concupiscence: the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life. That's from 1 John chapter 2. Concupiscence can be satisfied only in this life. The lust of the flesh requires a sexually responsive body, as Dante's Francesca da Rimini pathetically complains. The lust of the eyes is for stuff, desirable things to have. Pride requires recognition by and superiority to others. Living in the despair formed and defined by concupiscence, the soul remains blind to God and His mercy, and it becomes increasingly blind to the neighbor. We are spiritual beings whose lives and actions center on truth and goodness. Having a body does not make something non-spiritual. When the human person dies, only the soul, its spiritual principle, remains. All else that belonged to the deceased is gone. This means that after death, all that remains is what one has possessed spiritually: his knowledge or understanding and his love. The man of concupiscence has nothing, because all that he has loved is lost. Francesca cannot hold on to Paolo's sweet body. Scrooge's colleague Marley, I'm putting Marley in hell, okay? Marley will never hold a coin or add up a balance sheet. Satan and his minions are not in the least impressed by human pride. Nothing is left to the deceased but unfulfilled and insatiable desire. Hell is truly the pit of despair. So, St. Augustine famously wrote, "You made us for yourself, and our heart is restless until it rests in you." Created in the image and likeness of God, the human person knows that it must be more than simply flesh and blood, that it has a higher destiny than this earth and the grave. Classically, Christian thought has found this image to rest in the rational nature of human beings, in the intellect and will. Pope St. John Paul II carried this a step further, writing that if we examine the biblical account of the creation of human beings, quote, we can deduce that man became the image of God not only through his own humanity, but also through the communion of persons. What he means is that the human person was made for love, and that in love for the other person, he realizes this image of God. Indeed, the human person inchoately images the inner Trinitarian life of God. In Gaudium et Spes we read, "Indeed, the Lord Jesus, when he prayed to the Father that all may be one as we are one, implied a certain likeness between the union of the divine persons and the unity of God's sons in truth and charity. This likeness reveals that man, who is the only creature on earth which God willed for itself, cannot fully find himself except through a sincere gift of himself." Created in the image and likeness of God, the human being by his very nature is drawn to the God whom he unwittingly resembles. We are made for self-giving love. St. John Paul the Great begins his encyclical on morality, Veritatis Splendor, with the story of Christ's encounter with the rich young man who wants to know the way to eternal life. But Jesus reminds him that there is only one who is good. And John Paul writes, "Only God can answer the question about what is good, because he is the good itself. Therefore, the moral life is a response to God's goodness, his love." Having obeyed the Ten Commandments from his youth, the young man asked Jesus what else he must do, and Jesus replied, "If you will be perfect, sell all that you have and follow me." John Paul sees in this rich young man the figure of every man. If we want eternal life, we must obey the commandment in which, and I'm quoting John Paul, we find a precise expression of the singular dignity of the human person, and then follow Christ. By loving God as the good itself, and by loving one's neighbor in imitation of Christ, the person becomes like God, increasingly conformed to his goodness. Even though our nature is weak, God wants to grant this conformity to us. In this life, living in the body, The human person can distract himself from this restlessness of heart by seeking satisfaction, ease, and relief in passing things. W.H. Auden writes, "Faces along the bar cling to their average day. The lights must never go out. The music must always play. Lest we should see where we are, lost in a haunted wood, children afraid of the dark, who have never been happy or good." We can settle for a comfortable life, one with some adventure and much peace, with stimulation and rest. In John Stuart Mill's words, quote, "not to expect more from life than it is capable of bestowing." In this life, we can hide our need and yearning for God. In death, however, all is lost. Nothing is left but one's love for the good and his grasp of the truth. When Christ was asked what was the greatest commandment of God's law, he replied, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind and with all your strength." The basis for this commandment is not simply that God expects wholehearted devotion from his subjects as an earthly tyrant might. The reason for loving anyone or anything is its goodness. The extent and nature of a person or a thing's perfection determines the nature and extent of the love due it. So one's love for a 12-year-old daughter must be greater, more encompassing and generous than love for a 12-year-old scotch. I'm really reaching for great goods here, right? Okay. God is the perfect good. Furthermore, God is a personal being who, by his very act of creating, shares his bounty with his creatures. As spiritual beings, humans are capable of recognizing that love, responding in gratitude, and reciprocating it. Hence, God deserves a love more total and comprehensive than the love for any finite good. God's goodness and beauty call for a total response, a response of heart and soul and mind and strength. God will brook no rivals to his divinity. The first commandment makes that clear. "I am the Lord your God. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not bow down to them or serve them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God." That's Exodus 20. God knows that we need him and nothing less. Now, curiously, Satan is not so strict. It was his idea. He suggested to Eve that we become the little gods of our own lives. Satan's rule is like that of a crime lord, enticing his subjects with rewards to the lust of the flesh and the lust of the eyes and the pride of life, and even rewarding them to an extent. We should note, of course, that the rewards to concupiscence become decreasingly satisfying as the enjoyment of them goes on. Although every human member of his kingdom will eventually die, the devil and his minions can lead them patiently lead them deeper into his ways. Knowing that every one of us will die, he can lead us into his ways. So if the sinner should worship himself for a time, Satan is not worried. He can work with that. Indeed, he works most effectively when his hand is unseen. Those who fall under his reign in this life, even as they think themselves free and rulers of their own destiny, will find themselves enslaved to his tyranny in the next. And although Satan will not bow before God, his subjects must surely bow to him. Satan rules only by power, and he must be obeyed. He cannot tolerate the freedom that love requires. Jesus praises the widow who gives her mite to the treasury, Luke 21. But Satan appreciates not one of the works of his subjects. Even if you have shot up and terrorized a school, set off a bomb in a crowded marketplace, or run a concentration camp, you will not be a hero in hell. So we get back to Dismas. Dismas had botched his life. Regardless of what we may think about capital punishment, the good thief agreed that he deserved what the power of the Roman Empire brought down upon him. He had broken Caesar's laws, and Caesar's procurator put him on the cross. His life was not an example to us all, but his death was. Why did he speak to Jesus as he did? My guess is that he did know about this itinerant rabbi and miracle worker. He may have heard already that Jesus had spoken of a kingdom, but not one of power. And at odd moments, he too may have wondered if this might be the Messiah. When it comes down to the essential point, however, he knew as much as we do about this man from Nazareth. In particular, whenever anyone asked Jesus for salvation, whether from leprosy, lameness, blindness, or even from sin, Jesus responded mercifully to the person's faith. So hanging on the cross, Didymus acknowledged in faith that Jesus could hear and act on his prayer, "Remember me when you come into your kingly power." In response to this little sign of faith and mercy, Jesus welcomed him into paradise. I want to close with John Paul II's words from Redemptor Hominis. "Man cannot live without love. He remains a being that is incomprehensible for himself. His life is senseless if love is not revealed to him, if he does not encounter love, if he does not experience it and make it his own, if he does not participate intimately in it. This is why Christ the Redeemer fully reveals man to himself." Thank you.